Sean held out his hand, and as Ricardo took it, he said, "You did good work with the lions, Gappo. But then, you were never short of bottom."
"What kind of a limey word is that?" Ricardo asked.
"Bottom. How about a good Yankee word, then? Gajones." "That'll do," Ricardo grinned at him.
Claudia was standing beside her father, and now she smiled hesitantly, almost shyly, and took a step forward as if to offer her hand. She had released her hair from its plait and brushed it out into a dense, dark mane around her head. Her expression was soft, and her eyes big and dark and lustrous. In the Toyota headlights, her classical Latin features went beyond the merely handsome, and Sean realized for the first time that she was truly beautiful. Despite her beauty and her penitent attitude, he kept his own expression cold and forbidding, nodding at her curtly, ignored the tentative offer to shake his hand, climbed up onto the wing of the Beechcraft, and ducked into the cockpit. Sean had cut the airstrip out of the brush himself and levelled it by dragging a bundle of old truck tyres up and down it behind the Toyota. It was narrow, rough and short, with a gradient falling towards the river. He lined up with the Beechcraft's tailplane, backed into the bushes, and stood on the brakes, facing down the slope. He aimed at the lights of the Toyota at the far end of the strip while he ran up to full power on both engines and then let the brakes off. Just short of the trees at the end of the strip, he pulled on the flaps and bounced the Beechcraft into the air. As always, he crossed himself blasphemously with mock relief as he cleared the treetops and turned on course for Harare. During the flight, he tried to plan his strategy. The director of the game department was an old friend, and Sean had successfully dealt with him in equally serious circumstances. However, the deputy, Jeffrey Manguza, was a horse of literally another colour. The director was one of the few white civil servants still in charge of a department of government. Manguza would succeed him soon, the first black head of the game department. He and Sean had fought on opposite sides during the Bush War, and Manguza had been an astute guerrilla leader and political commissar. The rumour was that he didn't like the safari concession owners, most of whom were white. The concept of private exploitation of state assets offended his Marxist principles, and he had shot too many white men during the war to have any great deal of liking or respect for them. "It was going to be a difficult meeting," Sean sighed. Rima was waiting for him as he taxied in. As a modern Indian woman, she had abandoned the sari in favour of neat slacks. She was not so modern, however, that she wished to choose her own husband. Her father and her uncles were working on that at the moment, and had already come up with a likely candidate in Canada, a professor of Oriental religions at Toronto University. Sean hated them for it. Rima was an ornament to Courtney Safaris, and he knew that he would never be able to replace her. She had the ambulance waiting on the tarmac beside the light aircraft hangars. Regularly, Rima bribed the guards on the main gate with dried game meat from the concession. In Africa, meat, or the promise of meat, opens all gates. They followed the ambulance to the hospital in the Kombi. While Sean sat in the passenger seat glancing through the most urgent mail she had brought for his attention, Rima recited a list of the important developments during his absence. "Carter, the surgeon from Atlanta, cancelled." That was a 21-day safari, and Sean glanced up sharply. But Rima soothed him. "I phoned the German soap manufacturer in Munich, Herr Buchner, the one we turned down in December. He jumped at it. So we are full, back to back, for the rest of the season."
"How about my brother?" Sean interrupted. He didn't tell her that it was touch and go, that there was going to be an end to the season.
"Your brother is expecting your call, and as at 6 o'clock this morning the telephone was still working." In Zimbabwe, that was something that couldn't be taken for granted. At the hospital, there were at least 50 seriously ill patients awaiting admission ahead of them. The long benches were full of huddled, miserable humanity, and the stretchers were blocking the aisles and doorways. The admission clerks were in no great hurry and waved Shadrach's stretcher to a far corner.
"Leave it to me," said Rima, and she took the senior admissions clerk by the elbow and led him aside with an angelic smile, talking to him sweetly.
5 minutes later, Shadrach's admission papers were processed, and he was being examined by an East German doctor.
"How much did that cost?" Sean asked.
"Cheap," Rima answered. "A bag of dried meat."
Sean had picked up sufficient of the German language from his safari clients to be able to discuss Shadrach's case with the doctor. The man was reassuring. Sean said goodbye to Shadrach.
"Rima has your money. She will come to see you each day. If you need anything, tell her."
"I will be with you in spirit when you hunt Tukutila," Shadrach said softly.
And Sean had to clear his throat before he could answer.
"We will hunt many more elephant together, old friend."
And he walked away quickly. The next morning, when at last he got through to Johannesburg, the telephone line was crackling with static.
"Mr. Garrick Courtney is in a board meeting,"
the girl on the switchboard at Centaine House, the Courtney Group headquarters, told him.
"But he gave orders to put your call through directly."
In his mind's eye, Sean saw once again the boardroom, panelled in figured walnut, the huge Pierre-Neuf canvases framed by the elaborate panels, and his brother Gary sitting at the head of the long table beneath the crystal chandelier that his grandmother had imported from Murano in Italy, in the chairman's high-backed throne.
"Sean?"
Gary's voice cut through the static, bold and assured. How he had changed from the puny little runt who used to pee his bed. The job could have been Sean's if he had wanted it, and had he been prepared to work for it. Sean was the eldest son, but he didn't want the job. Still, he always experienced a twinge of resentment when he thought of Gary's rolls and Learjet and holiday home in the south of France.
"Hello, Gary. How's it going?"
"Ah, all well here," Gary told him. "What's the problem?"
It was typical of their relationship that any contact meant there was a problem to solve.
"I might need to put a bit of honey with the cheese," Sean told him diplomatically.
It was their private code for money to Switzerland, and Gary would understand that Sean would be bribing somebody for something. It happened often enough.
"Okay, Sean, just give me the amount and the account number."
Gary was Sean's partner in the safari company and held 40% of the shares.
"Thanks, Gary. I'll call you sometime tomorrow. How's the rest of the family?"
They chatted for a few minutes longer, and when he hung up, Rima came through from the outer office.
"I managed to get through to the game department at last,"
Rima had been trying all morning.
"Comrade Manguza will see you at 4:30 this afternoon."
Jeffrey Manguza was a tall Shona with a very black complexion and close-cropped hair. He wore silver-framed eyeglasses and a dark blue suit. However, his necktie was Hermès. Sean recognised the horse carriage logo, and his wristwatch was a Patek Philippe with a black crocodile skin strap. They were not your run-of-the-mill Marxist accessories, and Sean found that encouraging. However, the deputy director did not rise from behind his desk to welcome him.
"Colonel Courtney,"
he greeted him unsmilingly, using Sean's previous rank to let him know that he knew that Sean had commanded the Ballantyne Scouts, one of the elite Rhodesian groups after Ballantyne, the founder of the regiment, had been killed in action. It was also a reminder that they had been enemies and might still be so.
"I prefer plain Mister,"
Sean smiled engagingly.
"That other business is behind us now, Comrade Manguza."
The deputy director inclined his head, neither agreeing nor disagreeing.
"What can I do for you?"
"Unfortunately, I have to report an unintentional transgression of the game regulations," and Jeffrey Manguza's expression hardened and remained like that while Sean described the accidental shooting of the lioness and Shadrach's subsequent mauling. When Sean finished by submitting the written report that Rima had typed for him, Jeffrey Manguza let the document lie untouched on the desktop while he asked a few pertinent and unsympathetic questions. "You do realize, Colonel Courtney," he used the rank again, deliberately, "that I am obliged to take a most serious view of this entire business. It seems to me that there has been negligence and serious disregard for the safety of your clients and your own staff. Zimbabwe is no longer a colony, and you cannot treat our people the way you did before."
"Before you make your recommendations to the director, I would like to clarify a few points for you," Sean told him.
"You are free to speak, Colonel."
"It's almost 5 o'clock now," Sean checked his watch. "Won't you allow me to buy you a drink at the golf club, and we can discuss it in more relaxed surroundings?" Manguza's expression was inscrutable, but after a few moments, he nodded.
"As you wish. I have a few small matters to attend to before I leave here, but I will meet you at the club in half an hour."
He kept Sean sitting on the veranda of the golf club for 40 minutes before he put in an appearance. It had once been the Royal Salisbury Golf Club. However, the first two words had been dropped from the title lest they perpetuate the colonial past. Nevertheless, the first remark Geoffrey Manguza made after he had taken the chair opposite Sean and ordered a gin and tonic was,
"Strange, isn't it? A few years ago, the only way a black man could have got in here was as a waiter. And now I am on the committee, and my handicap is 5.
Sean let it pass and changed the subject to that of rhino poaching across the border with Zambia. Manguza made no effort to pursue that topic. He watched Sean through the silver-rimmed spectacles, and as soon as he stopped speaking, cut in immediately.
"You wish to clarify a few points for me," he said. "We are both busy men, Colonel."
The directness was disconcerting. Sean was preparing for a typically roundabout African approach, but he adapted his pitch.
"First of all, Mr. Manguza, I wanted to tell you what a high price I and my associates place on the Chiwewe concession."
Sean used the word price deliberately.
"I telephoned them this morning and explained this unfortunate incident, and they are anxious to have it resolved at any price."
Again he used the word and paused significantly.
There was a certain etiquette to be observed in negotiations such as these. To the Western mind it was bribery, but in Africa it was simply the dash system, a universal and acceptable means of getting things done. Government might put up posters in all public buildings depicting a booted foot crushing a venomous serpent under the slogan, "Stamp out corruption." But nobody took that very seriously. In fact, in a bizarre fashion, the posters themselves constituted official recognition of the practice. At this stage, Geoffrey Manguza should have agreed that recompense was due, or given some other indication of his willingness to listen to reason. He said nothing, merely stared at Sean from behind those glinting lenses until Sean was forced to speak again. "If you've finished your drink, why don't we take a stroll down the 18th fairway?" The club veranda was crowded and the happy hour in full swing with too many listening ears. Manguza swallowed the last of his gin and tonic and without a word led the way down the steps to the lawn. The last four ball was coming down the 18th, but Sean kept to the edge of the rough, and as the players and their caddies straggled past, Sean said softly, "I told my associates that you are the most powerful man in the department and that the white director is merely your rubber stamp. I told them that you had it in your power to sidetrack an official inquiry and dismiss any charges arising from this most unfortunate incident. I was so certain that I laid a bet of $10,000 with them. If I win my bet, those winnings are yours, Mr. Manguza, paid into any account you nominate anywhere in the world."